Examining the dead was never pleasant, John Thomas Rourke reflected. He observed, at the autopsy performed by Dr. Hickson of Eden One and Dr. Munchen, the physician attached to the military command of Wolfgang Mann. Captain Dodd observed as well. Rourke urged Munchen's presence on the assumption that a military doctor's knowledge of gunshot wounds might be useful. But as Hickson opened the body, it was all too obvious. She had been shot at close range by an indifferent marksman. The bullets extracted from her were clearly of 9mm diameter and little deformed. Rourke judged them as being fired from a .380. Whoever killed her thought to pick up empty brass from the ground nearby. Natalia carried a .380 stainless Walther PPKS in her shoulder holster, and as Dodd observed at the murder scene, it was fitted with a suppressor.
What more do you want, Dr. Rourke? Mona Stankiewicz named a Russian agent as a murderer. She was shot with what you call a .38.
9mm Browning short.
And the pistol was evidently fitted with a silencer. Since nobody heard a shot, Major Chemerovna is a Russian agent.
Was.
Fine. Was. But she might easily be identified as a Russian agent by a dying woman who might not have been able to recall her name. Major Chemerovna carries a pistol with a silencer in that shoulder holster of hers. What kind of pistol is it? The caliber.
.380, 9mm Browning short. It's one and the same.
And the gun that was used to kill Mona Stankiewicz is one and the same with the gun owned by Major Chemerovna.
Rourke looked across the body. Mona's skin flaps were laid back across the chest. He suddenly felt embarrassed for the woman, her naked body in public view, yet her secret still hidden. Dodd's face in the yellow light of the Coleman lamp and the diffused sunlight through the canvas held something in it Rourke had not seen there before. Hatred mingled with the stupidity that came from the absence of logic.
Think for yourself. Natalia is the enemy of the Soviet force sent against us. She is the friend of the Eden Project. Why would she kill one of its members? It's totally illogical.
Logic be damned, Dr. Rourke. This woman is or was a Russian agent. She owns the murder weapon.
No, logic will not be damned, Captain. You think. Mona Stankiewicz had something she wanted to tell me. Only me, not you. If it were something damning to Natalia, then why tell me? Natalia's friends. Why not tell you? Mona Stankiewicz wouldn't have labeled Natalia as a Russian agent. She knew better. It's obvious, at least in part, what Mona Stankiewicz intended to talk with me about. You're right, there is a Russian agent. But aboard the Eden Project. And whoever it is, assuming the person didn't smuggle his own weapon with him, must have somehow got hold of Natalia's pistol. Who better to implicate, right? What if the reason Mona Stankiewicz wanted to talk with me instead of you is because you're the Russian agent?
Look, Rourke.
Dodd leaned over the dead girl's body.
Let's find out if Natalia's gun is missing for openers. Whether it is or isn't, we can get Natalia's help. If the real Russian agent was concerned enough to implicate Natalia by using her gun, or one like it, if that's a real consideration, then the Russian agent might fear that Natalia could identify him. Evidently, Mona Stankiewicz could.
A Russian agent aboard the Eden Project? You're daft, Rourke.
Fuck you! I'm gonna talk with Natalia. If you want to come along, that'll be fine and dandy.
Rourke looked down at the dead girl. He drew the sheet up to cover her.
She's revealed all the secrets she's going to.
I'll see Major Chemerovna on my own.
I gave a sedative to her. She didn't sleep well last night. She'll need her strength. She'll be going down to Argentina with me tomorrow. If she took the sedative, after Eden 3 got down, she might still be asleep. We won't disturb her. You won't.
I've got Eden 4 landing in about an hour. There isn't any time to fart around, Dr. Rourke. We have a murderer to contend with.
Then I suggest we try to find him.
Rourke snapped off one, then the second of the rubber surgical gloves and threw them down. Rourke started toward the tent flap.
Dr. Rourke, I can have you disarmed, sir, if you interfere.
Rourke didn't look at Dodd as he answered.
Yeah? You go ahead and do that, Captain.
Rourke pushed through the tent flap into the afternoon sun, finding his dark-lensed aviator-style sunglasses in the pocket of his bomber jacket and putting them on.
Damn it.
Natalia Timurovna sat cross-legged on a blanket wearing one of Rourke's blue chambray shirts, the warmth of the fading sun pleasant on her bare legs. Her mind elsewhere, she worked with the cleaning gear for her guns. She was replacing the screw in the forward portion of the Smith L-frame. As she tightened the screw, the crane returned to its proper position and the cylinder closed up into its recess. She had cleaned all the guns thoroughly after the dousing they took in the rain. She oiled her leather gear as well. She put the L-frame down beside its twin. The set was a gift to the first and last president of US 2, Sam Chambers. He gave them to her as a reward for her role in aiding the evacuation of Peninsular Florida. She kept them with her ever since. She studied the American Eagles on the right side barrel flats. She remembered her uncle, General Ishmael Varakov. He once talked of the eagle and the bear fighting to exterminate each other. They had all but succeeded. Natalia thought of her uncle, dead like almost everyone else. She picked up the stainless Walther PPK-S American and thumbed the magazine release catch button automatically, then jacked back the slide and caught the chambered round in her palm. She set the magazine and the loose round on the oilcloth in a corner of the blanket. Something struck her as being odd. The brass of the round she popped from the chamber was very shiny, as though just taken from the box. But it shouldn't have been. She had chambered the round many times, touched it with her hands. She examined the top round in the magazine. It, too, was shiny, but, like the chambered round, should have been tarnished. Like most people who used a Walther, she carried its chamber loaded and with a full magazine. Since there was no manual slide stop, the convenient way to load the chamber after checking the pistol's condition of readiness was to work the slide and strip the top round from the magazine. Then take the round popped out of the chamber and load it into the top of the magazine. This constantly rotated the first two rounds. They would tarnish and show scratch marks from being worked in and out of the chamber. But these rounds showed neither.
What?
Natalia bent forward. She examined the magazine. She had dropped it once during some shooting, and the base plate had taken a scratch against a rock. The scratch was still there. She grabbed up the black canvas bag that she carried most often as a huge purse, but also converted to a day pack. She began fishing inside. Of the two spare magazines, one was without the finger rest extension at the base, and the other with. Natalia checked the finger rest extension magazine. Two of the witness holes in the magazine body showed empty, two rounds gone.
Who's been in my things?
Natalia threw the magazines down on the blanket and picked up the empty Walther, sniffing at the silencer tube still threaded to the muzzle. It smelled, and it should not have. She had cleaned the baffles after she last used it and replaced some of the packing. There should have been no smell. Natalia unscrewed the silencer from the muzzle. She dismounted the slide, then picked up the Walther cleaning rod. She used the rod with all her handguns. She inserted a patch in the slotted tip and then ran it down the barrel. But she already knew from the smell of the weapon it had been fired. The patch came out black-streaked from the rifling.
Major Termorovna, please stop cleaning that weapon.
She looked up from the stainless Walther. It was Captain Dodd, and beside him, dark-lensed sunglasses masking his eyes, stood John Rourke.
John, what?
Major Chernorovna, that pistol, it appears to have been fired, judging from the patch.
Two rounds are missing from one of the spare magazines, and I believe two fresh rounds were placed in the gun.
That pistol is a .38, is it not?
Yes, what?
And the thing on the blanket near the slide, the thing that looks like a miniature automobile muffler?
It's a suppressor, yes. The principle is the same. What of it?
As commander of the Eden Project fleet, in lieu of any other civil or military authority, I'm placing you under arrest for the murder of Mona Stankiewicz.
John Rourke spun on Dodd.
Are you fucking nuts?
Rourke, one more outburst.
And what? Go on, tell me what.
Murder? Of whom?
Mona Stankiewicz, backup flight officer for Eden 1. She was shot with a .38 caliber pistol. A silencer was evidently used since no one heard the shots, only her screams. She spoke only a few words as she died. She implicated the Russian agent as her killer.
And mine is the only 9mm short pistol in the camp, isn't it? And mine is the only suppressor, isn't it? And I am the only Russian agent, aren't I? And so I have to be the killer. But I'm not!
She started to reach into her purse, but she remembered she had no cigarettes, had not, again, begun the habit. She looked up into Dodd's eyes instead.
Do you actually believe this?
How long was the PPKS out of your sight, Natalia?
I didn't give myself the sedative, but I did get a little sleep. And then I got up and went for a walk. I only carried these.
She gestured toward the twin Metalife custom L-frames with the American Eagles engraved on the right barrel flats.
I left the Walter here. And, well, after I came back, I took another shower and washed my hair.
She touched at her hair. It was still damp.
And I just slipped on these things and came outside to clean my guns.
Where was the Walther while you were out?
I had it in the shoulder holster and left it in my bag.
She gestured toward the massive black canvas purse.
I wore the pistol when I had the helicopter up while Eden 3 was landing, and I took it off afterward.
Rourke turned to face Dodd.
All right. So somebody who knew Natalia had the only silencer in the camp got into her things while she was walking or washing her hair and killed Mona Stankiewicz, then replaced the pistol, but shifted the loads around so she wouldn't catch on right away.
Did anyone see you when you were walking, Major, or when you took your shower?
I have a tent here at the edge of the camp, as you can see, and I share it with Elaine Halverson, and I haven't seen Elaine since Eden 3 came down. I left camp by the most direct route. No one saw me. And I usually shower alone. And no one saw me go to the showers unless someone was watching me that I didn't see.
I find this very hard to believe, Major. Dr. Rourke has weapons. So does his wife. So do his son and daughter. And so does Mr. Rubenstein. Why were yours used?
Perhaps because of this silencer. I don't know.
Dodd ran his hand through his hair and shifted.
What I said, Major, still stands. Please consider yourself under arrest. Rest assured, however, that I'll leave no stone unturned in attempting to get to the bottom of this. And if you are innocent, you will certainly have my apology.
Dodd lifted the holster flap on his .45.
I'll have to ask you to stand up and come with me.
Both of John Rourke's Detonix 45 seemed to spring of their own will from beneath his coat. His fists closed around the butts, both pistols inches from Dodd's torso.
You breathe wrong and you're dead.
No, John!
Natalia was to her feet, putting her left hand between the muzzles of Rourke's pistols and Dodd's body.
No, not this way, John. I've done nothing wrong, and Captain Dodd will be able to prove that. I know he will.
I am supposed to leave for Argentina tomorrow. I wanted you with me.
She searched for some image of his eyes behind the lenses of his sunglasses, but saw only her own eyes reflected in them. She reached up to his face, slowly, gently removing the glasses, holding them in her fingertips.
Nothing will happen to me. It will all be settled by the time you get back, John. And Paul will still be here, won't he? And Michael and Annie and Madison? Take Sarah with you. She's very good. She'll help you as well as I could have.
No.
I can show you how to use my lockpicks if Captain Dodd doesn't need them as evidence. You or Sarah can take the Walter, so you have a gun with a silencer. Any other things I have, they're yours, of course.
That's not what I want.
She reached her right hand up to his cheek. The anger flushing his face was warm to her touch. His dark eyes were squinted against the light. She realized how much she loved him. Thought she knew how much he loved her, and how futile it all was.
I'll be all right, John. I can look after myself. I really can. And I'm innocent. You taught me to believe in your system, that it was the best system. Now here is a chance to prove it.
She didn't believe that Captain Dodd would uncover evidence that would implicate someone else. Whoever killed this woman evidently decided the crime should be connected to her gun. Natalia had no alibi. And there were the damning words of the dying girl.
I can't leave you.
You have to leave me. We both know that.
Rourke closed his eyes. He simultaneously lowered the hammers of both pistols, letting them hang at his sides.
Did Karamazov... could he have an agent aboard the Eden Project?
I don't know, John.
Don't be ridiculous, Dr. Rourke. Every man jack of us has a security clearance that's lily white.
Those are the worst kind. A perfect security clearance is always the one that's flawed, because nobody's perfect.
And what about you, Doctor?
If you'd move for that 45 on your hip, you'd be dead.
Rourke shoved the pistol from his left hand into its holster. Then he repeated the process with the gun in his right hand. It took two hands always to conveniently reholster his guns because of the trigger guard brake design of the holsters.
I'll change, if I may, and then I'll accompany you, Captain.
She didn't wait for an answer. She handed back John Rourke's sunglasses, leaned up on her bare toes and kissed his left cheek lightly, then started for her tent. She didn't delude herself. Dodd thought she was guilty, believed it, and nothing would convince him otherwise. But if she let John Rourke commit some act of violence against Dodd, John and all of them, all the people she loved, they would be outcasts from human society. She let the tent flap fall closed behind her. Natalia sat on the edge of the cot. Her mind was functioning on two levels. While she awaited the inevitable, she might as well be comfortable. She wouldn't be going into battle. On impulse, when she left the retreat, she took a skirt and a pair of sandals. She also wondered how they would punish her for this murder, and how she could prevent John Rourke from ruining his life and the lives of his family by interfering. Michael was awake, but not sitting up. His eyes seemed alert and clear, though, as clear as they could with the medication. Paul Rubinstein sat up, even though Rourke cautioned him before he attempted it. Sarah sat near the small table beside the lit Coleman lamp. Annie and Madison respectively sat beside Paul and Michael at the edges of the cots. John Rourke stood near the tent flap, too angry to sit.
Dodd's gonna railroad Natalia, and I'm supposed to leave for Argentina tomorrow. I don't want to go until this murder investigation is settled. But if I don't go with Mann, and his faction loses and this Dieter Byrne is executed, we'll be facing Karamazov's forces alone, and we may wind up facing the Nazis, too. God damn it, there's no good choice.
Listen, John, I've been through too much since the night of the war to sit here and listen to you giving up. I know that if the Russians and these Nazis attack us, you will never give up. None of us will. But they have weapons that are a whole lot more sophisticated than ours. And there are apparently hundreds of them, more likely thousands of them. We'll lose. I mean, maybe all of us here, and Natalia. We can stay together and keep fighting from the mountains and harassing them, but we won't win, John. You've got to go with Mann and his people.
Mama is right.
She is, Dad.
It isn't my place to speak, Father Rourke.
No. Of course, you have a voice in what we do. Go ahead, Madison.
We will care for Natalia. But I think we will all die, Natalia too, if you do not help the Colonel Mann in his fight for freedom.
She's going to make a hell of a sister-in-law. Michael and Annie and Madison and I, we can take care of things here, John. Because if you don't go, you and Sarah and Kuranami and Elaine Halverson, if you don't go, well, I've been doing a lot of thinking. And the whole idea of Nazis, it gives me the creeps. But if this guy Mann is what he says he is, and I don't think he'd have anything to gain by lying to us, but if he's what he says he is, then he wants to kick the real Nazis out of power. I gotta be for that, you know?
Rourke only nodded, staring past the Coleman lamp at his wife's shadow.
And as far as Natalia is concerned, like Madison said, she'll be safe.
There's a Russian agent at work in the camp. That's probably how Rozdestvenskaya and Karamazov before him knew so much about the Eden Project in the first place. One of the men or women aboard fed the information to the KGB. And whoever this person is, it's important to him or her to get Natalia out of the way. Perhaps Natalia might be able to recognize him or recognize something about him that would betray his identity. I doubt Mona Stankiewicz was murdered just to be a victim. If I'd only forced her to speak her piece when she first talked to me. Shit! Well, anyway, Karamazov will assume this person is still alive and find a way of using him or her against us. The key to proving Natalia's innocence is one of the keys to our survival here. Damn, we don't even have the whole fleet down and we've got the same world we had 500 goddamn years ago.
Sarah Rourke looked up at him, smiling thinly as she pulled the blue and white bandana from her hair, then ran her fingers through it. She was a pretty woman, Rourke thought in the instant.
What's the matter, John? Too many people?
Rourke dropped down on the canvas folding chair opposite Sarah, reached out and took her hand. She didn't withdraw it.
Yeah. I was used to our solitude for so long. It looks like everything is starting all over again. Maybe the people who propounded cyclical views of history were right. I don't know.
What did you fight for, you mean?
I always knew what I was fighting for. I always knew that I fought to stay a step ahead of the insanity. But the crazies just keep on coming, Sarah. It hasn't changed. People are still running around trying to kill one another. Violence is still everybody's answer. Human life is still cheap. I don't know.
You've always tried, John, to do the right thing. For us, more than for yourself.
He started to speak, but she touched her fingers to his lips.
You're a decent man. A fine man. Maybe you're too fine. There's too much nobility in you. Your honor's like a suit of armor to you, John. You could never accept the fact that the rest of humanity wasn't perfect, just like you. So you fought against the idea, and you isolated yourself, John. If the killing ended, John, if the world was what you wanted, John, what would you do?
Rourke looked down at her hand in his.
Start a clinic, Mamie. Get a real hospital going. Pretty soon there'll be babies born. Life's starting up again.
He looked up at her, across the table, into her eyes that were only half visible in the lamplight.
But I don't think it's ever going to end, Sarah. I just don't.
You've never been an optimist. Just a pessimist who refused to give up. You are that. And I love the idea of you so very much.
It was as if they were sitting all alone in their house that was no longer there. And it was late at night, and the children were in bed.
Woman couldn't ask for a better man to love. But I'll never agree with you. I can't see life the way you do. I'm just not that logical. It's a conscious choice with me, John. I refuse. I'm very sorry. Sorry that you were right. And you're sorry, too. You carry a burden I couldn't carry, John. I never could. It's been hard trying to share it, and I know I really haven't. It'll be good to go with you to Argentina. A lot of places, well, a man can't get in, I think, but a woman can. It sounds silly after all these years of being married, but I don't think we ever really knew each other. But we can now, and whatever happens between us, we'll be better for it, I think.
I love you, Sarah.
I know you do.
I don't think I gave you a very good life, Sarah, did I?
No, John, for once, you're wrong. Oh, by the way, Kuranami found a volunteer who speaks German to go with your group. I think the man's name is Forrest Blackburn. So, between you and Blackburn, there'll be at least two of our group who speaks German.
She stood up and drew his head against her breasts, and Rourke felt her breath against his face, and her lips touched at his forehead.
Stay here, miss.
The Eden Project guard holding the M16 pulled his head back out of the tent flap.
She did it! She's the one! Kill her and I'll be done with it!
Tommy, bitch!
She perched on the edge of her cot, drawing her feet closer to the side of the bed, pulling her skirt down lower over her tightly squeezed knees. She realized she was frightened.
All right! Major Tremorovna is Russian, but her guilt hasn't been proved. If it is, she'll be punished in a lawful manner and only for the death of Mona Stankiewicz, not for causing World War III.
God damn it, Captain. Mona and I were engaged.
Hasselden, I know how you feel, man.
Her right hand moved up from her knees along the tops of her thighs, pulling up the beige linen to the inside of her left thigh. With a scarf, she had tied the balisong to her leg. She undid the scarf. The knife came alive in her right hand as she stood. The full skirt dropped to below her knees as she moved toward the rear of the tent. She put the scarf in the left-hand pocket of her skirt. Her left hand moved along the interior wall of the tent. The balisong's Weehawk pattern blade bit into the canvas and then ripped downward from the height of her chest to the level of the canvas floor panel. She looked back toward the front of the tent and the flap. Natalia Anastasia Temerovna reached back to the cot and grabbed the dark blue cardigan sweater there. She caught it up and pulled it over her shoulders, tossing her hair free of it, and buttoned the top button at her neck to keep the sweater from falling. She pushed her sandaled left foot through the opening she cut in the rear of the tent. With the open balisong in her right hand, she thrust it into the darkness ahead of her as she stepped the rest of the way through. She was out of the tent.
Get out of our way, Captain!
Natalia started to run, cursing herself for dressing like a woman. The sandals were impractical for running. The sweater would give her scant protection against the evening's chill with the sleeveless blue knit top she wore beneath it. The skirt would catch and rip on briars and thorns if she made it far enough away to start for the mountains. And the balisong was her only weapon.
The bitch got away! The commie's loose! Hunt her down!
Hang her!
Natalia ran. As she reached the edge of the camp, she slowed, stopped.
There she is! Over here!
Look out! Shit! She's got a knife!
Two of the crew ran, armed with handguns. At the distance, she doubted their ability to hit her, except by accident. She wheeled to her left, starting into a dead run, but something hammered at her legs and she fell, hacking into the darkness with her knife.
Oh, geez! She cut me! She cut me!
Natalia's left hand hammered up and out, the heel of it contacting bone. The weight rolled off of her. She pushed herself to her feet, but arms reached out for her. The knife in her right hand hacked through the darkness. Something slammed against the left side of her head. She started losing her balance. Her right arm was twisted back and around, and she felt her grip go and the balisong fall away.
Bastards!
Her left knee caught one of the men in the crotch. Her left hand straight-armed another man in the face. Then her left wrist got caught in a grip that felt solid as a vise, and her arm was wrenched back. Hands grabbed at her legs, dragging her down. The weight of a man crushed her down. Her left arm was pinned to her side. Her right arm was twisted behind her. A little more pressure, and she knew it would break. Hands held her ankles pinned. She couldn't see clearly.
Hell, this cable be as good as a rope. Good enough for her.
I'm doing it. Mona and I were gonna be married. I'm doing it!
Then do it!
For God's sake, you're supposed to be the cream of humanity and you're a mob! For God's sake, don't do this thing!
Natalia was dragged to her feet. Her right knee found a target. A hand slapped at her and her head sagged back. She felt her knees buckling. They pulled her. She didn't know to where. But when she tried using her feet even to walk, the pressure on her right arm increased.
Stop it!
The pressure didn't decrease, and they snaked the cable around her neck.
Tired of the back of Rourke's truck! Drag hanger!
Fun's over!
Natalia looked in the direction of Rourke's voice. The light from the camp backlit Rourke. In silhouette, she could see the Detonix 45s in his hands.
Dr. Rourke, I can handle...
Apparently you can't, Captain.
Natalia felt the cable loosen slightly at her throat.
Let her go! Help her up and let her walk over here!
John...
The pressure on her arm eased, then was gone. The noose of cable fell from her neck to her chest. She sat up, took the noose from her body, and threw it down, and stood up. She looked at her skirt and mechanically began dusting it off, her knees weak.
I've got Natalia's balisong, John.
You should be in bed, Paul.
Covering this end with my schmeiser instead, John.
Give my friend some room. Go over to John. Natalia, can you walk?
Yes, I can walk.
Natalia's throat ached, and her right arm felt as though it weren't an arm at all, but just a bone full of pain. She started slowly toward John Rourke. She saw faces now, as the glare of headlights washed at a tangent across the crowd surrounding her. She could see John Rourke's face now, half in shadow, half in light. She could see the gun in his left hand dully gleaming, the gun in his right hand still in shadow.
I've got the truck, Dad.
It would be the camouflage-painted truck Annie drove.
Get my bike in Natalia's, Annie. Do it quick. Sarah.
Right.
Natalia saw a figure stepping beside Rourke. She saw Rourke's body tense in silhouette, and then the tension faded. It was the wiry frame of Kurenami backlit in the glare of the headlights, a pistol in his right hand.
I am here, Dr. Rourke. Elaine Haverson is with me.
You and Dr. Haverson, get on the truck, back it up, and keep the lights on this mob.
Dr. Rourke, what the hell are you doing? I can take charge here now.
I'm going to Argentina, Captain, remember? Huh? And I'm taking Natalia with me, along with Sarah, and Akiro, and Elaine Haverson. And I'm not going to insult your intelligence by mentioning what's going to happen if anybody tries stopping us.
This woman is a murderess!
Yeah, right, Captain. Paul and Michael will represent my interests here. And if you or anybody else takes any reprisals against them, then you'd better hope the people under Karamazov get you, or I will. And just to keep you busy while I'm gone, why not look for the real murderer and find Karamazov's agent before Karamazov comes back and you find out you got an enemy inside as well as outside?
You'll be a wanted man, Doctor.
Natalia was nearly to Rourke now. Her legs still felt weak. As she sagged toward him, his right arm reached out to her, enfolding her, supporting her.
I got Madison to round up your clothes. Sarah found your guns and put them in the truck Annie was driving.
John, I... You'll be an outcast now.
I was never anything else.
Natalia rested her head against Rourke's shoulder.
John, you guys do what you gotta do in Argentina. I'll find a murderer.
Natalia looked up at John Rourke's face, feeling his breath against her skin.
I know.
Antonovich was sorely tempted to reach to his hip and draw the Stechkin MK7 from its holster, but he did not. If he drew his pistol, it might make the men around him think he was nervous or afraid. He kept walking instead, slowly, looking from right to left and then behind him. His men formed a ragged wedge on both sides of him as they moved through the jungle. Scouts confirmed what electronic surveillance earlier indicated, that the surrounding area of habitation ringing the mountain was unfortified except for guard towers at the four compass points. The mountain itself, apparently the stronghold of the Nazi force, seemed so well fortified that it would take firepower beyond that available from the helicopter force to penetrate it or destroy it. But Major Nikolai Antonovich had to see for himself. He kept walking slowly to avoid noise. The jungle heat felt surprisingly bearable and spring-like. He could remember jungles once teeming with wildlife, with birds and insects, but this one did not. Wild fruit grew in abundance. The foliage was ridiculously bright green. But there was no life.
Eric! Eric, come here!
Antonovich signaled to his men to halt with hand and arm movements. Now he drew his pistol. The Stechkin MK7 clenched tight in his gloved right fist. He moved ahead, signaling his lieutenant to accompany him.
Mama, watch this!
Antonovich dropped to his knees and moved forward beneath the cover of the foliage, the debris of the ground, rotted leaves clinging to his field trousers. He crept forward, glancing once behind him to ensure his lieutenant was still there. He parted another of the low-to-the-ground broad-leafed plants. He could see a woman wearing a filmy-looking summer weight dress, blonde hair restrained at the nape of her neck, with a large bow, and a child in khaki shorts and a short-sleeved shirt running and playing, throwing a red ball to the woman who, on closer inspection, seemed little more than a girl. The woman caught the ball and threw it back to the child, almost bowling it across the manicured green of the grass. The woman rearranged her dress.
Eric, throw me the ball, dear.
Antonovich thought there was music in the sound of this mother playing with her child. The little boy threw the ball toward her again, and she caught it. Antonovich looked to his right and saw the guard tower. It was glass enclosed and probably air-conditioned. He would not risk a stray reflection from his field glasses, so he studied the tower with his naked eyes. Perhaps two men. One stood by the nearest window. The second appeared to be sitting. Antonovich could barely make out the top of the head when there was movement. They were more watchers than guards, he realized. The other tower to his left was merely a speck against the horizon. But less far to his left, well back from the woman and the little boy with the red ball, stood the mountain, an exposed pinnacle of granite. Massive doors stood at its base. The doors might be brass, he could not be sure. Two massive stone pillars flanked the doors on either side. Enormous flames danced at the tops of both pillars. Antonovich turned his attention back to the boy and the woman with him. As he did, he saw a bronze bust the height of a pillar set in the middle of the garden. He recognized the face. It was the unmistakable face of Adolf Hitler. He looked away to the mountain itself. It rose so high that its summit was all but obscured in wisps of white cloud. Perhaps 100 feet above the doors were long parapets. On these parapets, he could see armed men moving in some sort of regular pattern. There would be fortifications at the top of the mountain and aerial reconnaissance. He thanked his own foresight in keeping his reconnaissance far back, relying on electronic observation rather than visual. Anti-aircraft emplacements ringed the summit. The nature of the guns he did not know. It was suspected, by heat source identification, the entire mountain and the green space that seemed carved from out of the jungle were ringed with surface-to-air missiles. His helicopters would stand no chance against the Nazi fortifications, regardless of the disposition of the Nazi troops, who were now thousands of miles away from protecting their stronghold. Fighter bombers were the only thing. Fighter bombers and a ground assault to penetrate the main entrance if they were timed perfectly.
It could work.
He watched the pretty young woman and the child for a moment longer. They reminded him of things he could not afford to consider until the conquest of Earth under the leadership of the hero Colonel. But he wanted to reach out to them very much and touch them gently. There was a French term for it Helena Sturm couldn't remember. She massaged gently at the sides of her distended abdomen, watching Eva Mann as much as she listened to her.
Helena, you are all right? I cannot help but notice.
I'm fine, Eva. I've had many babies and this one is just telling me that he will be coming soon, but not too soon.
Helena Sturm smiled, moving her hands from her abdomen to the table that separated them. It was a favorite place for the women of the officer corps, located on the top floor of the field officer's quarters and overlooking almost the entire complex. The streets below bustled with pedestrian traffic, the few private vehicles and the mass transport machines. The educational center could be seen in the far distance beyond the government buildings. She thought of Manfred and his loyalty to the youth.
You are not listening to me, Helena.
I am sorry, Eva. I was thinking of my oldest son.
Do you think that he spies on you?
Helena Sturm realized that the teacup she had been lifting from its saucer was making a rattling noise in her right hand. She looked about the huge room. Other women like herself sat at tables dotted about it. She recognized most of them. As her eyes scanned the room, Maria, the fiancée of her brother Siegfried, noticed her and waved. Helena smiled and waved back. Siegfried was with her husband, Helmut. They were in North America, fighting under the leadership of Eva Mann's husband. Helena was afraid for them both, and for Colonel Wolfgang Mann as well, because if he failed, the conspiracy against the leader would doubtlessly be found out in its entirety, and there would be many arrests. She touched again at her abdomen, shifting her position on the smallish, wooden-framed, armless chair. The seat of the chair was not padded enough.
Helena?
No, I do not know. I think that Manfred watches and listens very carefully. He's very political, I think. But he does not spy on me for anyone. Not yet.
If he were to learn...
If Manfred were to learn, we would all be executed. But he would not inform on his own mother. I cannot believe that.
Helena had no appetite for the sandwich, thinly sliced sausage with lightly scrambled egg. The smell of it nauseated her. But she needed to eat regularly for the baby. She picked up one of the quartered pieces and nibbled at it.
My husband did not attempt a radio contact last night, I was informed. This means that either something has gone wrong, or that he feels that the time is too close, and he cannot risk a radio message being discovered.
I think it is that. That he doesn't want to risk discovery. I just know he is all right.
I spoke with a member of Field Marshal Richter's staff this morning. Official communications are still coming in. They have encountered a strong Soviet force in the southeastern segment of what was the United States. Their first skirmish was successful for our forces.
That will only make the leader more powerful. He can use the Soviets as a threat to increase his demands for a total war footing.
But there was a message for me from Wolfgang that he had found a Rose. I think this is a code that he has found a means for aiding Dieter Bern.
Helena Sturm looked anxiously around the room. To mention Dieter Bern was to risk arrest for treason.
I pray that you are right, Eva.
And if my husband and his legion should be unable to reach the complex in time, then we shall do it ourselves. We are agreed on that still?
Yes, still.
Helena Sturm felt her baby move.
Still.
If he is executed, all is lost.
Helena Sturm watched Eva Mann. She looked at her sandwich, the same as Helena had ordered, then neatly folded her napkin beside the blue willow pattern plate.
I will be right back.
Eva Mann pushed her chair out and stood, smoothing her skirt along her thighs with her hands, the fingers splayed. She slung her bag over her right shoulder and started toward the rear of the restaurant. Helena watched Wolfgang Mann's wife. The clothing, the hair, the walk, the casual smiles, and more casual nods to the women she passed. Her husband was the ranking field officer under the general staff and would, after the first phase of the campaign, be promoted to general officer's rank. But if he attempted to save the life of Dieter Bern and smash the power of the leader and were to fail, he would be publicly executed. Helena Sturm took her own napkin from her lap and set it down beside her own plate. She could eat nothing now. Aerial observation confirmed considerable activity at the site in the West Texas desert where Helmut Sturm tracked the Soviet force, as per the orders of his commander, Standartenführer Wolfgang Mann.
Herr Hauptsturmführer!
Sturm turned to the voice of the young soldier.
Yes, Corporal, what is it?
A message from Untersturmführer Bloch, Herr Hauptsturmführer.
Sturm took the folded form, unfolded the message, and returned the man's salute. The message informed Sturm Siegfried's forces were in position and ready for the assault. He folded the message and dropped it in the left outside pocket of his battle dress uniform tunic.
Very good, Corporal. Return to your units.
Again, the corporal saluted, and Helmut Sturm returned it, the younger man doing a very sharp about-face and breaking into a dog trot, his assault rifle at high port, his steps carrying him leadenly across the drifting sand. Sturm scanned the area distant from him, where the helicopters awaited, looking for his Obersturmführer. He saw the man and signaled the attack was on. Sturm began to walk, ignoring the background sounds of the helicopter's rotor blades picking up speed. He tugged his gloves into position and broke into a run for his machine's open fuselage door. As he ran, he patted at the full-flap holster on the belt at his waist, his pistol. He estimated the Soviet force on the ground at being in rough parity with his own, though Soviet planes arrived with alarming regularity, as though a full-scale invasion were in process. Still, he would have the element of surprise. Sturm ducked his head, then vaulted aboard. He clapped his sergeant on the shoulder.
Hermann, to victory, eh?
He settled his radio headset into position, jerking his left thumb upward. His pilot nodded. The machine started to rise. In the distance, he could see the mirror signals from the highest of the dunes, signaling those elements on the ground under the leadership of Siegfried and Sturm's two other line platoon leaders to begin their attack. He ordered radio silence, lest a message be intercepted by his quarry, the Russians. A radio silence would be his excuse with Standartenführer Mann that he had not obtained proper authorization for the attack. As he stared below through the machine's chin bubble, he considered Standartenführer Wolfgang Mann. Mann was born to one of the best families among the original elite who founded the complex more than five centuries ago. His party membership assured, he never sought party advancement. Eva Mann was one of the most beautiful women Sturm ever had the good fortune to see. She, as well, was from an elite family, equal to that of the Standartenführer. But it was rumored theirs was a love match, not one of the doomed arranged marriages within the elite, marriages that were publicly strong and privately weak. The Standartenführer was a superb athlete in his youth. In his rise through the military, he revamped the air cavalry force to his own ideas and methods, while still a junior officer, sometimes in direct opposition to the general staff. Soon he would be appointed to the general staff as the youngest field marshal in the history of the military organization of the complex, the first true field commander in five centuries. He was called in some quarters the modern Rommel. Yet as brilliant a field commander as Rommel had been, he had also been a traitor to Hitler. It was this aspect of the Rommel-Mann comparison that worried Helmut Sturm. Mann once associated with Dieter Bern, whose whispered name was punishable by death. Wolfgang Mann had been one of Bern's supporters against the leader's drive to re-Nazify the complex. But Mann was too highly placed to touch because of family and influence, his career too meteoric to crush. Not a pilot by training, Mann could fly as well or better than his best pilots. He was at once a strategist, a tactician, and beloved by his men. Helmut Sturm saw his Standartenführer as both an idol and a danger.
Herr Hauptsturmführer!
He turned from his musings to the face of his pilot.
Yes?
We are in position, Herr Hauptsturmführer.
I know that.
It was time to break radio silence. He flicked his headset switch on the console.
Eagle strike!
On the ground to the north, he could see the puff of smoke from the first of the mortars.
What?
Vladimir Karamazov sat bolt upright in his cot. He swung his feet over the side and stuffed his feet into his boots. Mortar fire. He struggled into his clothes and stepped through the door to see one of his officers running toward him. Karamazov squinted against the bright sun for a moment and thought of John Rourke and his damned sunglasses.
We are under attack, comrade Colonel Karamazov!
Get our gunships airborne!
He ran past the man, dismissing any further conversation, dodging right. threw himself to the sand as another mortar struck, a wave of sand crashing down across his back. He beat the sand from his body as he forced himself to his feet, running, shaking his jacket free of the sand and shouldering into it. His personal gunship was waiting for him, its rotor blades already turning. But he heard different sounds, vehicles. He looked to his right, to the sound of gunfire and the sight of flames. Machines that looked like miniaturized tanks were crossing over the high dune at the far edge of the encampment's perimeter. They were roughly the size of the efficient Volkswagen Beetles of 5 centuries earlier, but rode high off the ground, wore heavy armor, and rolled on balloon tires instead of treads. The first wave of the machines bounced over the dune heading toward him. Karamazov ran from the mini-tanks, ran from the swastika emblazoned on each machine. He was cut off from his gunship as a second wave of the mini-tanks swept in from the opposite end of the camp. He heard the gunfire, the machine guns, but they were not his own. He looked skyward as he dove for cover behind a rank of packing crates. The sky was filled with helicopters. Some were his own, but others, the majority of the others, were not.
The devil with you!
He pushed himself to his feet and ran. He had to reach his machine so he could take charge of the response, otherwise defeat was certain. He reached under his jacket, breaking the Model 59 from the leather, working off the thumb safety. He shifted the pistol to his left hand, patting at the outside pocket of his flight jacket for the little Smith & Wesson Model 36 Chief. He opened the pocket flap and drew the snubby-barreled revolver. With a pistol in each hand, he ran. He looked behind him. The mini-tanks were consolidating on the central section of the encampment. His men were resisting, but had no armored vehicles, and even the new assault rifles would not penetrate armor. A small squad of the Nazi troopers were racing on foot and cutting him off from his machine. Karamazov threw himself to the ground near the dead body of one of his men, stuffing the revolver into his hip pocket, picking up the dead man's assault rifle. Karamazov rolled and fired the assault rifle toward the small squad of Nazis. He could hear and see gunfire from the open fuselage door of his helicopter. Two of the Nazis were down. The sand near Karamazov's head seemed to explode over him, and he rolled left, firing wildly. He heard the roar of heavy machine gun fire. He looked up to see one of his own helicopters. The Nazi who had been firing at him was down, draped clumsily across the body of his comrade, the back of his khakis laced with the red of his blood. Karamazov threw down the assault rifle and ran across the ground into the storm of sand made by his beating rotor blades. He threw himself through the opening.
Take it up now!
He crawled forward, out of the opening in the fuselage, as the machine rocked and swayed under him, around him. It was then that he glanced at the digital chronometer on his left wrist. He hauled himself to his feet, fighting the sway of the machine as he moved to his seat. If the jet fighters of Krakowski's lead elements were on schedule... As if to echo his thoughts, he heard several sonic booms. He was fully forward now, sinking into the seat opposite his pilot.
Pull back, so I can see these.
Yes, Comrade Colonel!
The machine banked hard to port. Karamazov watched the horizon line for a moment through the chin bubble. Then, as the machine leveled off, he watched through the windshield. Black streaks crossed the sky, followed by 10 Nazi mini-tanks erupting as contrails dissipated in the black and orange fireballs of air-to-ground missiles. The sand rippled under the impact of submachine gun bullets. The Nazi infantry forces fell back toward the perimeter of the camp. Karamazov's own helicopters were closing in battle with the Nazi machines, but some of the fighter bombers were breaking off, engaging more of the Nazi helicopters. Karamazov once saw an anti-aircraft bombardment, shells exploding in mid-air. It was the same effect now. But rather than shells exploding, the Nazi gunships were exploding, vaporizing before his eyes. The windshield through which he stared was smudged black with oil that gushed toward his machine when another from his force caught fire from a peripheral missile strike, and a secondary explosion then vaporized the craft. Helmut Sturm kept his hands locked in his lap to prevent anyone seeing them shaking. War was no longer something talked about at night or studied from books or an exercise. It was reality. Helmut Sturm, his forces triply decimated at the least, knew inside himself that had Standartenfuhrer Wolfgang Mann been in command, somehow the roles of victor and vanquished would have been exchanged. The worst image of the battle was machine gun fire from one of the shadow black fighter aircraft that appeared out of nowhere and stitched across the position held by his wife's brother and his men. Helmutsturm wondered how he would tell his wife, Helena, that her brother Siegfried was dead and that he could not even retake the boy's mangled body from the field. He closed his eyes. It was unmanly to cry, he had been taught. Annie Rourke squeezed the towel tighter, the water dribbling from it into the basin, then refolded it and laid it across Paul Rubinstein's high forehead, smoothing back his thinning hair.
You were so brave. I love you.
He opened his eyes then, and she leaned over him more closely, kissing his lips lightly.
What? Oh, shit. I'm sorry,
After Daddy and Mama and Natalia got away with Lieutenant Kuranami and Dr. Halverson...
I remember. Dodd, he...
No, it wasn't Dodd. He was at the other side of the crowd. It was that man Blackburn, the one who was supposed to go with Daddy to Argentina. He hit you with that wrench and he tried to take your submachine gun.
What? Where? Wow, my head hurts.
I shot him in the left thigh. Just a little.
What, are we under siege here, or what?
Annie put her hands into her lap, smoothing her skirt, studying the pattern and the material, rather than looking into Paul's dark eyes.
No. After I shot Blackburn in the leg, Captain Dodd and Craig Lerner and Jeff Stiles and Jane Harwood, she's the commander of Eden 3, they all got guns and forced the crowd to disperse after they forced all of them to put down any weapons they had. Captain Dodd, he had an assault rifle pointed at you. I laid down my gun. So Captain Dodd, Lerner, Stiles, and Jane Harwood are the only ones in the camp who are armed. Right now. There wasn't anything else I could do.
She watched Paul's eyes. The lids fluttered and his jaw was hard set, as though he were in pain.
What happens if the Russians come back and pay us a visit?
That's the same thing I asked Captain Dodd. He said then he would rearm us.
Well, gee whiz, that's smart.
Dr. Munchen came by. He said your head will be all right. And he told me that Mama and Daddy and Natalia got away with Colonel Mann. They're on their way to Argentina. They're safe, for now.
Paul reached up his right hand, and she took it in hers. She waited for him to speak.
Annie, how's...
Michael's asleep. Madison's asleep, too.
She gestured behind her to the opposite side of the tent. She had her father's bad habit of second-guessing what people were going to say and answering questions before they were fully asked.
You gotta get something going, so we can find out who the murderer really is. With a Soviet agent in the camp and Dodd disarming everybody, hell if...
I know.
She touched her lips to his hand a moment.
What can I do, Paul?
She knew what to do, but wanted to let him tell her.
You're gonna have to go to Dodd and demand that he let you help. The killer has to be from Eden 1 or Eden 2. Eden 3 wasn't on the ground long enough for any of the cryogenic sleepers to be awake. Unless it was somebody from the flight crew. The commander, or the flight officer, or the science officer. Eden 1 has a master computer with all the personnel files. Dodd told me his instructions indicated that was in case they landed, and reviving all of the sleepers proved impossible or impractical. The files were to allow him to pick and choose who he needed for specific tasks from among the sleepers. There's gotta be something to link somebody from Eden 1 or 2 or the flight crew of Eden 3 to Mona Stankiewicz. I'd say it was her boyfriend, maybe.
Hazelton?
Yeah, but he was on Eden 3, I think. So he wouldn't have been awake yet. If Dodd'll let you use his computer and you can find some kind of link, it'll be subtle.
I can use Daddy's Apple IIe, and I taught myself BASIC. I should be able to use the onboard computer.
Good girl.
Paul smiled. She touched her lips to his hand again. His plan was exactly the same as hers, but she was glad she'd let him say it.
See if you can find Dodd and be careful. Even if that Soviet agent doesn't have a gun anymore.
I know. Don't forget, Daddy taught me the martial arts.
When Natalia gets back, you have to get her to teach you a few things. She knows a lot, and the techniques she uses are probably better for a woman.
All right, Paul. Will you be all right here?
Fine. If I need anything, I'll shout for Madison.
Dr. Munchen told me you should stay in bed for at least 24 hours in case you got a slight concussion.
All I got's a big bump. And as soon as I'm up and around, I'm going to find that Blackburn guy and give Eden Project Dentist something to do.
She leaned over him and kissed his mouth lightly. She was very much afraid of moving about the encampment and of leaving Paul alone. But if she didn't find the murderer of Mona Stankiewicz, she was certain the murderer would find them. She stood up, pushing her hair back from her shoulders. She smiled at Paul.
Don't get into trouble.
You be careful.
Captain Dodd was reluctant, but it was Jane Harwood, the commander of Eden 3, who finally convinced him to give Annie access to the onboard master computer of Eden 1.
Wow!
Annie spent the first 10 minutes in the cockpit just staring at the instruments. Very vaguely, from when she was very little, she remembered seeing one of the space shuttles taking off. She watched it on television. And her father had videotapes of several of the space shuttle launches that she watched at times over the years on his machines at the retreat. She saw every tape he had several times over. And, of course, she saw the landing of the Eden fleet. But the fascination at actually sitting behind the controls of one of the shuttlecraft awed her. Annie got over the initial sight and got to work on the computer. It was not as difficult a task as someone might suppose, she reflected, settling herself more comfortably in Craig Lerner's chair. She was only recalling information, not programming, and the master computer was programmed to accept English.
Recall personnel files, Eden 1.
Annie punched return. The display asked, "What system?" Annie considered. The personnel would be listed alphabetically, certainly, but also by job specialties. She decided on alphabetical order, but for the heck of it, typed catalog systems. A lengthy list appeared on the terminal. Alphabetical, job specialty, sex, blood type, military experience, age. Annie let the catalog run itself out, then selected the alphabetical listing. The first name was Abramowitz, Arthur A. Annie closed her eyes for a moment. It would be a long job. Annie walked across the camp under the fading light of another setting sun. A breeze toyed with her hair and skirt as she walked. She felt stupid that she had not seen it earlier. For the secret of Mona Stankiewicz's death was with Mona. And Annie found it there. She hadn't found the killer yet, but she had found the reason. She sat now beside Paul on the small chair next to his bed. Annie stared at him, and Paul opened his eyes. She learned she could make him do that, and it frightened her a little.
Annie?
Paul? Are you awake?
Yeah. What's,
It's almost sunset. I found something in Mona Stankiewicz's personnel file. I haven't found a clue to who the killer is, but I know why, anyway.
Paul started to sit up, and she gently nudged him back.
You rest. You can lie down and hear this just as well.
Not even married yet, and you're already telling me what to do.
You can tell me what to do all you want, and I'll do it. Or I'll make you think I am.
Annie perched on the edge of the chair, the hem of her skirt brushing at her ankles as she moved her feet.
All right, Mona Stankiewicz was first-generation American. Her parents were born in Poland. That do anything for you?
Before the night of the war.
The Russians invaded Poland. It was a good number of years before, wasn't it?
Uh-huh. Yeah, Polish trade unionism was the apparent rationale, but Poland was becoming too uncontrollable, and the Russians cracked the whip.
What if Mona Stankiewicz had relatives living in Poland, and the KGB threatened to harm them? And the only way she could prevent that was to sell out. I talked to Jane Harwood for a while after Captain Dodd gave me permission to use the onboard computer, and I found out something very interesting. The primary and backup flight crews had been given special briefings and special training sessions with classified material. All of the primary and backup flight crew personnel were Americans, except for the flight officer on Eden 6, an Englishman. Jane Harwood insisted they had no inkling that the Eden Project was a doomsday contingency, but some of the special training included use of radiation monitoring equipment, landings with various types of aircraft on various types of runway surfaces, stuff like that. So Mona would have had all the special training and the secret information. This is the juicy part.
Women.
All right, smarty. But anyway, the flight crews and the backup flight crews were the only ones that got any detailed information about the cryogenic process, right? And the serum. The way you and Daddy and Natalia talked about it, well,
Karamazov had a lot of information he shouldn't have.
So someone in the flight cruiser was a KGB agent and threatened Mona Stankiewicz's relatives and forced her to give information.
That's what I just said.
Annie turned to Madison and smiled at the girl as she sat up. She had been sleeping, curled up in a ball near the foot of Michael's cot. Michael's breathing seemed even, and Annie dismissed checking him.
Hi. You slept for a long time, Madison.
I didn't know I was so very tired, Annie.
Pull up a chair. We're solving a murder mystery.
The poor Mona Stankiewicz?
That's the one.
Madison stood up and stretched. She straightened her clothes, walked across to their side of the tent, and sat in the second chair. Annie watched her. Madison still looked half asleep as she sat down in the chair placed near the foot of Paul's cot, then began adjusting her clothing. The skirt was impossibly wrinkled.
Annie found out that Mona Stankiewicz had relatives in Poland.
What is Poland?
It was a country before the night of the war that the Russians occupied.
Oh, the Russians are the bad people, yes. Except for Natalia, who was very good.
Not all Russians were bad people, just some of them. And the worst ones were in the KGB.
But this KGB, was not Natalia a member of it?
She was an exception.
Anyway, we found out that the Russians were blackmailing Mona Stankiewicz into giving them special information about the Eden Project.
Blackmail? Oh, some of the men aboard the Eden Project are black, like Dr. Halvorsen is black.
No, not blackmail. Blackmail. They threatened her relatives to get her to give them information. But when she woke up, and the night of the war had come and gone, she realized the KGB had no hold over her. And whoever murdered her realized that too. That's why he or she killed her.
The blackmail did this.
No! Whoever worked or works for the KGB. And the person could be black, or white, or yellow.
Oh. Yellow male?
Oh!
Annie needed to spend time with Madison, lots of time, bringing her up to speed on basic knowledge. Michael taught her driving, shooting, and lovemaking, spending his greatest efforts on the latter pursuit.
Whoever did kill her is going to figure you'll get onto him with that computer. You better wait until I'm up and around. Dr. Munchen stopped in. He says tomorrow afternoon I can spend a little time on my feet if I take it slow.
We don't have till tomorrow afternoon. I'm going back to that computer right now and check for whoever seems too perfect.
Before you do that, check with this Jane Harwood. She's in the clear or close to it. Get her to put you in touch with a few people she feels certain can be trusted. What if the killer turns out to be somebody Dad just won't buy?
You're right. Then Daddy and Mama and Natalia might not be the only ones with a revolution on their hands.
John Rourke pulled at the canteen. The water had a sweet taste to it, different from the water in northeastern Georgia somehow, but good to drink. Several hours of daylight still remained. Wolfgang Mann walked from where he had been talking with a Hauptsturmführer beside one of the helicopters.
You should have brought an American cowboy hat, Herr Doctor.
Rourke looked past Mann toward where two of Mann's men were saddling horses.
I never thought I'd see one of them again. The Eden Project has horse embryos and cryogenic freeze along with other animals, but still.
With customary German efficiency, we had the foresight to assume that some domestic animals might indeed be worth saving. What if a synthetic fuel had not been discovered? A small portion of the complex was set aside for the nurturing of livestock, breeding pairs, and when it finally came time to return to the land, one of the first tasks was the breeding of the animals to increase their numbers. Unfortunately, no dogs, no cats. I understand from materials I have read that such animals were very amusing and actually kept as pets.
Yeah.
But we did, of course, keep beef cattle growing throughout our enforced entombment as a source of protein. Chickens as well. Horses were the only other ones. Certain types of fish, of course.
If secrecy is so important, how were you able to arrange that the animals be here?
Since horses had a potential military value, they were naturally assigned to the armed forces. The commander of the unit in charge of their breeding and their training is one of us. One of those who oppose the leader and work for the freedom of Dieter Bern. Hence, the horses you see here.
Rourke found himself watching Natalia. She was slowly approaching one of the animals, a massive bay with white stockings all around and a white blaze on the head, the animal pawing at the ground with apparent nervous energy.
I'll make you a deal.
If all this works out successfully, after we've dealt with the Russians, if I can find a way of getting them from here to Georgia, we'll,
Horses? Of course, they are the best. I have heard they are crossbreed of Arabian and American quarter horses. Stamina, intelligence, and speed. They were bred for nothing else.
Rourke already saw the animal he wanted for himself. It reminded him of his own horse, Sam. He hadn't seen the animal since before the night of the war. Sam served Sarah and his children in the earlier stages of their flight. This horse was darker, more gray than white, the forehead broad. The Arabian in it showed strongly, with black stockings, flowing black mane and tail.
Are any of these animals owned privately or a man's special mount?
You see a special one?
Well, the gray, is he...
Which? He is yours, Dr. Rourke. You have made a fine choice, I think. And as to the other mounts, all that you request, which we can supply for your entire family, if you like.
There was a saddle at the retreat, a very special saddle given to him years before the night of the war. He worked a case with the DEA and the Mexican authorities in breaking up a ring of terrorists. The Mexican he worked most closely with shipped the saddle to him. The saddle had the big Mexican horn and the high cantle, the leather intricately tooled. It was completely black. It would go well with the big gray.
All right. Thank you.
Rourke nodded, left Mann, and walked toward the animal. He would not call the horse Sam after his own mount from so long ago. A name was an individual thing, and he struck on the perfect name for the horse. He would call it Wolf, after the man who gave it to him. But he would not say the name aloud, not just now. They landed some considerable distance from the complex, Mann proclaiming that the electronically enhanced scan of the radar system above the complex was too sensitive to be risked. Natalia rode ahead, beside Elaine Halverson. Both women rode well. Kurinami, in the lead just ahead of them and beside Mann's Hauptsturmfuhrer, looked somehow strange in his baseball cap, his white coveralls. Rourke and Mann brought up the rear. Sarah rode beside one of Mann's men, who was practicing his English. Rourke watched his wife, the loving way she touched at the bay mare. It was almost identical to her horse, Tildy. She lost Tildy at the same time Rourke's horse Sam was lost after a narrow escape from a swollen lake and the bursting of its dam. Rourke thought of Michael. Sarah told him of Michael's bravery, as had Annie years later.
I early became fascinated with the history of the place we call the complex, its beginnings, its construction. It was forbidden to travel in the tunnels beneath the complex and surrounding it. Forbidden because there were many possible dangers from cave-in and rock slides. But like most young men, I cared little for danger and more for adventure. So I explored the tunnels without the knowledge of my parents or my friends. I became expert in maneuvering there. And since it seemed logical that there should be, I persevered, Herr Doctor, until I had discovered the way out of the complex via the tunnel system. When I originally planned the rescue of Dieter Bern, I entertained the thought of using the tunnels as a means of escape from the complex. I never dreamed that the leader would be launching the campaign so soon. I believed that part of his reasoning was that I would be away when the execution took place on Unity Day.
Sounds like a real sweetheart.
He is a clever man. I shall warn you now. If somehow he has discovered my intended use of the tunnel system, it will likely not be closed, but booby-trapped instead. I believe that is the Americanism. Booby-trapped, yes?
Yes.
Rourke nodded, uncomfortable in the English-style saddle. He never cared for English tack. It seemed to him as sensible as riding a motorcycle mounted atop a postage stamp.
These tunnels, where do they end? How do we enter the complex?
It takes some great amount of explanation, Herr Doctor. I will tonight make a diagram which will better enable you to understand.
Rourke looked ahead. The sun was sinking in the west.